Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Reparation H goes down to Guatemala to introduce herself, America's Funt, you know, the fun aunt.
That's right.
To the Guatemalans and President Alejandro Giamatti. And by the way, not received warmly.
Did you see what they did?
The protest signs, Kamala, Trump won, Kamala, mind your own business, Kamala, go home.
Well, my favorite was the Kamala, Trump won, why are you here?
Kamala, stop funding criminals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
how'd she perform on the world stage there? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA and then a quick comment.
Not the warmest reception, in part because in advance of her much-anticipated arrival, you had the president of Guatemala say, yeah, the Biden administration is responsible for sparking this migration crisis at the border, which is not dissimilar from what other Central American presidents have said, including the president of Nicaragua.
He told Lester Holt last night real quick, because he sat down with a one-on-one with the Guatemalan president and said, look, we have this problem because Biden is president and said, come on in.
Right. And then Kamala says, what, the border's closed now?
Yeah, that's what she said. Don't come here, Dan.
Do not come. We, as one of our priorities, will discourage illegal migration.
Mm-hmm. Not very assertive, and it was kind of halfway through her wishy-washy speech. She just looked a little nervous. I mean, granted, it is her first foreign trip as vice president. Tried to explain why I'm here. This is why I'm here, people.
This is one of our highest priorities, and I came here to be here on the ground to speak with the leader of this nation around what we can do in a way that is significant, and I will continue to be focused on that kind of work as opposed to grand gestures.
Why so serious? Where's the giggles? I like it when she giggles. I don't like it when she pretends to know things. These are two of the dumbest people that have ever inhabited the presidential and vice presidential offices, by the way. If you haven't picked up on that, I mean, Biden is a known quantity for 5 decades, so you know he's a dope, and this has nothing to do with aging. He was a dope at 30. Kamala Harris is a complete cipher, which is why nobody was buying Kamala Harris as a presidential nominee during that primary campaign.
She dropped out even before the Iowa caucuses, didn't she?
And so now they're being forced to publicly say something we know they privately don't believe. And normally, in normal times, in good times, they would publicly not believe, too. I mean, this was, she was part of that gaggle of socialists in that primary arguing about who is going to be most lenient when it comes to illegal immigration, who is going to be most aggressive when it comes to open borders. And now the border's closed?
Wait, what? That's news to people. And she went on.
I'm honored to represent my country here in Guatemala. Let's pave a path where we create an opportunity for others to become the first in their family or their community to do those things that perhaps others didn't think they were capable of.
She wants to try to help the Guatemalan people with programs and things like that so that they stay in Guatemala. But it was very uncomfortable, I have to tell you, watching it. It's just, she wasn't assertive. I really don't believe that she believed what she was saying. She was just kind of reading off a script.
Of course she was. Back at the ranch, on any given day in Del Rio, Texas, hundreds of Venezuelans wade across the Rio Grande from Mexico into the United States. They're carrying more belongings than illegal aliens from most other countries. One woman who said she was a photographer back home, had her professional Nikon camera equipment in her backpack. They arrive on shore and proceed to change into dry clothes, tossing the wet ones on the ground. They're looking for a better life. They're looking to flee the ravages of socialism in Venezuela that the Democrat socialists here seek to imitate. 10,864 Venezuelans pour into Texas border region, up from 135 last year.
Oh, my God. I mean, 180,000 tried to cross illegally in April alone, and most of them Guatemalans, yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is why we have the Biden administration sending out this memo to ICE attorneys to, you know, use discretion when it comes to prosecuting cases involving illegal immigration. The memo drafted May 27th includes a number of factors ICE prosecutors should consider as mitigating factors when looking at whether a case should be pursued or not. Oh, so don't come, but if you do, we're not going to do anything. This is more like what Biden has been saying.
Mixed messages.
Since they realize there's a concern, not a crisis. Don't say crisis. Concern? An issue? A happening? An event? Not a crisis at the border, and they've had to reposition themselves, as you heard Kamala Harris saying, not only because they have this crisis at the border that they've induced, but because they're suffering politically as a result. Anytime you see a socialist change their rhetorical position, you know what's happening. They're not actually changing their position. They're just changing their posture because they have a political problem, and that's what the Biden administration has at the border.
And AOC, this group, you know, the Spice Girls, responded, "This is disappointing. First, seeking asylum at any U.S. border is 100% legal method of arrival. Second, the U.S. spent decades contributing to regime changes and destabilization in Latin America. We can't help set someone's house on fire and then blame them for fleeing." And that was AOC's response to Kamala Harris saying, "The border's closed. Don't try and come here."
Yeah. AOC should just focus on taking care of grandmama and leave the policymaking to the adults. Speaking of the political problem they have, we're going to talk about that. The political problem they have, the political opportunity Republicans have, as evidenced by local elections in Texas, and that's with Latino voters in America. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about border policy, really, with Reparation H's visit to Guatemala yesterday. And something else happened at the border throughout the state of Texas, local races. And that is some big cities with minority white populations went Republican. The top of that list is McAllen, Texas, which is a border city of 150,000 people, 85% Hispanic. McAllen, Texas elected their first Republican since 1997.
Good for them.
Yeah, this is
awesome.
Javier Villalobos. Bum, 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 bum. and this is a overwhelmingly Democrat town.
Of course.
And he took out Democrat Veronica Vega Whitaker, a fellow McAllen City Council member, campaigned as a conservative, said he wanted to cut water and sewage fees, called for compassion for undocumented migrants, but the safety of local citizens had to be the first concern.
Yep.
Huh. In addition to that, Fort Worth, which is more than a million people, America's 12th largest city.
Yeah.
Only a third of them are white. 37-year-old white chick, Maddie Parker, Republican, won in a walk over the Democrat there. Voters also elected Jim Ross as mayor of Arlington, a suburb of 400,000 people that borders Fort Worth. That's only 40% white. Also Ross, former local police officer, endorsed by several police associations who liked his anti-crime platform.
How are you going to defund him now? because you're not, because the voters don't want you to.
Well, isn't this interesting? What does that portend for the real big cities? I mean, the big cities that are in real trouble. I'm not talking about the Fort Worths of the world. I'm talking about the New Yorks and the Chicagos and the L.A.s. Do you see perhaps a Latino revolt that could change the balance of power? Forget the traditional paradigm, Republican, Democrat, white minority. This is changing. And the NRSC, National Republican Senatorial Committee, recognizes it. Rick Scott, senator from Florida, who's heading up the NRSC this cycle, saying he sees the Republican Party winning a majority of the Latino vote in the not-too-distant future. The conclusion from a survey they recently did, that the highlights which were memorialized in Bill McGurn's column in the Wall Street Journal this morning, the political future isn't California, it's Florida. Florida's electorate, as is noted in the report, substantially less white than it was in 2000, and yet it is more Republican than it was 20 years ago. That's where this is going. You know why? Because Latinos are not down with the socialist Spice Girls. They're not down with AOC's rap. They're not down, generally speaking, not just with socialism, but with this critical race theory, identitarian politics that has consumed institutions they care about just like everybody else does, schools.
And I think COVID and the lockdowns had to do with it, too. They didn't like what certain Democratic governors were doing, and they just wanted to enforce the fact that we need to keep Texas Republican, we need to keep Florida Republican. And also, this is going to be, you know, it's a promising sign for the midterm elections.
Well, yeah, I don't know how much you read into this as a canary in the coal mine for the midterms. I think it's limited, but it is interesting what's happening in Texas, because remember, the concern is twofold. One is that the people coming across the border, you know, that the Democrat socialists are trying to import their voters. They can't win with the American electorate, so they're going to import a different one that they can win with.
Trying to get liberal college grads who, you know, don't know what they're doing to move to blue states.
Well, that's,
to turn them
that's,
red.
That's secondary, but I'm talking about illegal immigration.
Okay.
Why are they supportive of open borders? Because they're trying to import an electorate. Well, it turns out that McAllen, Texas, border town, 85% Latino, once people get here, legally or illegally, but those who want to live here legally, want to live here productively, which I concede is most, want a better life, well, they start looking around and saying to themselves, like any other person would, like any American would, wait a second, who's making sense here? Who is making sense as it pertains to my opportunities? The life for me, myself and my family? Why did I come here again? I came here for the policies that I'm leaving? And now, you may not get somebody insulated from terrible public policy like some Silicon Valley dink moving from California to Texas to understand that I'm leaving a place for particular policy reasons. Why would I want to support those policies, the place I'm going? You may not get that Silicon Valley entrepreneur to figure that out. But I think a lot of people that are not insulated from terrible public policy, that are aspirational, that haven't made it yet but would like to, they have a different attitude.
And I know that a lot of Hispanics that came here legally cannot stand people who come here illegally.
Yeah, well, the Latino population is not monolithic. I know that that's the way it's always described, just like the black population is monolithic. Unfortunately, with respect to their voting habits, the black population is much more monolithic. But that's changing, too, particularly among black men, as we saw in November of 2020. But yes, the Latino population, not just with, you know, ethnicity, Puerto Ricans versus Cubans, for example, but also how many generations have you been here? First, second, third, if you look at the survey research, very different attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, calls for, you know, analysis at the individual level rather than at the identitarian level that the socialists want people to use as the basis of analysis. So just some of the survey work that was done here, really interesting. One question that was asked, basically Milton Friedman versus AOC. Some people say free market capitalism is the best form of government because it gives people the freedom to work and achieve. Some other people say that socialism is the best form of government because it is far more, it is more fair and equitable to working class people. Some people say free market capitalism is the best form of government because it gives the people the freedom to work and achieve. Others say socialism is the best form of government because it is more fair and equitable to working class people. Which statement reflects your view? Two-thirds of Latino respondents opted for the Milton Friedman position, free market capitalism. Less than 1 in 5 supported the AOC socialism position. Isn't that interesting? 67% very concerned their kids won't have the same opportunities me and my family came here to find. 58% said too many people in America are happy not to work and just live off government assistance. 80% agree that public schools are failing. 67% agree that Americans are losing our traditional values centered on faith, family, and freedom. 72% agree we should do what is necessary to control our southern border. Latino voters. 65% oppose the Democrats' bill that would make voter ID illegal. And a full half of Latino individuals surveyed agree many of the policies Democrats say help all minorities actually end up hurting Hispanic families. Boy, that's a real mission field. And it's encouraging that Republicans see it. And if they didn't see it before, some of these results the other day in Texas should really drive it home.
You know what I kind I find kind of humorous is that the Fort Worth mayoral race, guess who campaigned for the Democratic candidate? Beto O'Rourke and Housing Secretary and Julian Castro.
Of course.
And he still fell.
Bobby O.
8 points. Yeah. But not even the star power of Beto O'Rourke helped push him over the line.
Star power.
Yeah.
We'll see how.
Remember Paula Ferris when she interviewed him? You're a rock star.
Oh, I remember. We'll see how AOC's endorsement of Wiley in New York City goes in that mayoral race.
That's going to fall flat.
She's not going anywhere. That's a defund the police candidate who, by the way, has private security.
Of course.
AOC's candidate in New York City. You know, there is, you know, again, I don't want to read too much into Texas, but this demographic shift that's happening with Latino voters, I mean, this political shift as the demographics change. And I like the report concluding the future is in California, the future is Florida. Less white, but more Republican. Fine by me. As I've said many times on this show,
come to the party.
Give me an aspirational Latino voter, aspirational black voter, middle income, hardworking, playing by the rules. I don't care where you're from. I'll take those individuals over River Forest and Hinsdale housewives every day of the week. I'm happy to trade them out. I'm happy to never have to
deal with them again.
Pretend that I have anything in common with or am concerned about those champagne, those ghastly, ghastly, terrible champagne socialist women in the suburbs. The farther the Republican Party can get away from having to spend 1 ounce of mind share from those terrible people, the better it's going to be as a party, the better we're going to be as a country. Bill in Lincoln Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Amy. This is just American history that people just should be. They ought to darn well know, and Dr. Cass, which I consider more of a doctor than somebody else, he's written about this because he's, of all people, first-generation American. This goes back to the Germans, the Irish, Italians, Poles, Czechs, Lithuanians, everybody, that they all settled down in Pilsen. And right now, the Hispanic person, that it's not Martin on the block from Guatemala. It's their children that grew up or got houses around Midway Airport and Orland Park. Their grandchildren now have houses in Palos and New Lenox. And they're college educated. They have cars. They have house payments. So I'm second generation American, and I've Americanized like everybody else. So it's not a new story here. It's
right.
America.
No,
thank you, too.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Bill. It's not a new story. It's a different population or different populations telling the same old story. That's the greatness of America. That's what's fun about it. What's not fun about it is the identitarians, the Marxists masquerading as identitarians, pretending to care about vulnerable populations, marginalized populations, when they're the ones doing the marginalization, where they're the ones creating the vulnerabilities and the fact that people who should know better, who have made it, don't or don't pretend to or pretend not to. Why? Because they feel guilty for some reason. They feel guilty. And they have, you know, basically a superiority complex, which says, well, I made it because I'm me. But those poor people, they can't do anything without me. Right? Marvin in Burlington.
I agree with that last caller. I mean, in a lot of ways, these folks have a fresh understanding of the countries that they're coming from. And they don't want, they're trying to leave that form of government. They want to come here and have a different form of government. They don't want to go back to the way it was. And the Democrats are promoting that those ideas and that those principles that they're trying to leave. Just like a lot of the Eastern European folks that came here after World War II, they didn't want anything to do with communism. They wanted the freedom to make themselves whatever they wanted to make themselves and their families. They're just like everybody else. They want a better way, and they don't want the government telling them how to do it or what to do.
I know.
And,
yeah.
I think it's
exciting, isn't it?
You know,
I mean,
yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the Republicans, you know, whether you like them or not, you know, Trump exposed a lot of these do nothing guys who just sit around on their hands, like the Illinois Republicans, and they're gonna have to be a more active party and results orientated party and address these issues and not just give it lip service, but you know, show it with their votes, show it with their rhetoric, and actually promote it and force it, because otherwise there's not going to be much of a Democratic or a Republican party.
Thanks for the call, Marvin. Well, right. I mean, this is the opportunity here. It's that the numbers don't lie, and the election results in places like Texas don't lie either. There's real opportunity there, and Republicans should put a full court press on. Absolutely full court press. And the range of issues, while they're focusing on just, you know, navel gaze and cast yourself as a victim because you have brown skin, that's the Democrats' value proposition. Republicans are talking about, what are we going to do to improve your economic prospects? What are we going to do to make sure your kid's in a public school that isn't failing? School choice, scholarships, you know, 80% of Latinos surveyed think the public schools are failing. Right, because they are failing. They're right. It's not going unnoticed. Republicans should be zero focused on those meat and potatoes issues and Red Rover, every Latino voter in the country to their side. There's just no question about it. It's obvious. And I hope they do it, because sometimes, you know, the obvious is missed. Mike in Plano.
Hey guys. This trend that you're talking about is very much real. You even saw bits and pieces of it here in Illinois in the November election. There were some blue-collar neighborhoods that are mostly minority that actually swung rightward. A couple neighborhoods in Chicago, but also a few towns like Aurora, Joliet, places that have pretty large Hispanic populations. Now, the problem is that you have Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell at the top of the ticket, and you're not going to win over more of these voters with those two guys at the top of the Republican ticket. You're talking about a couple of Chamber of Commerce, big business Republicans. They've never tried to court Hispanics. They're still chasing the white women in the suburbs, those same women that were bothering you in Elmhurst a few weeks ago, Dan. Those guys still think those women are going to vote Republican. Yeah. And Kevin McCarthy even said a few weeks ago that people who believe in America first were nativists. Now, he just joined in with the CNN and MSNBC anchors on that one. So why should a guy like me even go out and vote a Republican ticket with those two guys? Why should I want to make Kevin McCarthy next Speaker of the House? We're going to get the same stuff.
Well, I don't know about that. Thanks for the call, Mike. Look, I think some of the criticisms that you offer are warranted. I mean, I think they're founded. But obviously, why should you want Kevin McCarthy to be Speaker of the House is because you want to end the Biden administration. That's why. Real simple, real straightforward. You want to stop this administration at 2 years. You don't want to go the full four in terms of the policy agenda, clearly. Secondly, you know, the face people on the ground are different. This election in 22 is not going to be a referendum on McConnell in the Senate or a referendum on McCarthy in the House. And by the way, Rick Scott clearly has a different attitude about this than Mitch McConnell does. That's good news. He's riding point on the campaign side for Senate Republicans. So, you know, the new crop of conservative, maybe to some extent populist Republicans may have a different attitude than McCarthy does. Certainly will have a different attitude than McConnell does. And they'll change the caucus, and that'll change what leadership can and can't do. So you can have a backbencher revolt, as it were, to be that small government, I hope, not just populist, you know, railing against the established order, but, you know, principled small government, free market capitalism that nearly two thirds of Latinos said, yes, I support that over socialism. I mean, these are the tenets that need to be expounded upon and driven home across the country. And, you know, whoever wants to jump on board, obviously you're welcome. But let's focus on people who are already inclined to our worldview and bring them into and who are not inside the tent right now, bring them inside the tent. And then, you know, to the extent that the composition of the party starts to change a little bit, then the composition of the leadership will, too. And, you know, ultimately that's going to need to happen, particularly in the Senate.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. An important case, both legally and politically, out of California. Federal District Court Judge Roger Benitez of San Diego. Tell you what, this guy may be a Supreme Court contender down the road. So remember his name, Roger Benitez, out of San Diego.
Roger Benitez, got it. Roger,
he issued the opinion overturning California's 1989 assault weapons ban, saying, like the Swiss Army knife, the popular AR-15 rifle is a perfect combination of home defense weapon and homeland defense equipment, good for both home and battle. The AR-15 is the kind of versatile gun that lies at the intersection of the kinds of firearms protected under the Supreme Court's Heller decision. Yet the state of California makes it a crime to have an AR-15 type rifle. Therefore, this court declares the California statutes to be unconstitutional. And then the human cry ensued.
No, please.
He stayed his decision for 30 days, giving the Attorney General of California 30 days to appeal, which the Attorney General of California, of course, dutifully said he would. But that does not in any way take away from the importance of this case. And it's also interesting, too, because this is something that Second Amendment rights types like me would hail, something that the Republican Party, generally speaking, would hail. And yet when it comes election time, we say it's okay, we, the leadership of the party, say it's okay if you want to, you know, be a little Bloomberg-ish on guns if you're in the suburbs. And you got some fraidy cat women and male impersonators who think if you support the Second Amendment that you want to install a gun turret on the top of everyone's home.
Some people won't even let you have kids over at their house or play dates if they know you have a gun at the home.
Public health epidemic.
Scared.
Oh, yeah. Public health epidemic.
Was it locked up? Well, yeah. Of course.
Are you speaking from personal experience?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is a few years ago. A parent said, well, I heard, you know, you're a Republican. I've heard you talk on the air that you have a weapon. Is that weapon secured? And she has every right as a parent to ask that question.
And you said, these are my weapons right here. You see these? These are licensed with the state, my two
yeah,
fists.
Yeah, coming at me. Right. No, I just don't. Yeah, no. And I'm a responsible gun owner. I separate my ammo from my weapon. You don't need to know more than that. And of course, I have a safe. And I don't have the key sticking out of the safe. It's in a separate location. But I also have taught my children about firearms, and they've gone to the range with me, the shooting range, and they know that this is not a toy, and this is not something you show off or you brag about to your friends, because one of your friends could be friends with that gangbanger, and that's what they do, then come to your house and steal your weapons.
You're a safe gun owner. You have your gun locked in a safe with the key in some other location. That's ideal for home defense.
No, I've got to
Wait a second. Wait. Before you take the TV, I got to get the key. And then my ammo is over there in the closet.
No,
so just hold on a second so it's a fair fight.
I call a social worker first, Dan. Well, and then.
Yeah.
Then I call LeBron James. And then, you know, I go through the. I tweet him and ask him what the channels of operation.
The protocol. Right. Absolutely. You know, I want to slow. excuse me, sir. I assume it's a sir.
Yes.
I understand you're here to rob me and or do other bad things. But let's escalate this according to established protocols, as I'm sure you've heard from Michael Bloomberg, as well as
Superintendent Brown, the new protocol. So if you run, we're going to try to engage you first.
Makers. Sure.
Try to talk to you. But no, I've got, that's just when I leave the house. I make sure that the kids don't just, trust but verify.
Yeah.
They're still teenage boys, although they look like grown men.
And so the upshot of this was
I still
like
had to play
mom
day.
Said,
yeah.
Oh, I don't feel comfortable. Because
yeah, and you know what? That's fine. But then I explained to her about, gun usage and why I have it and the Second Amendment right. And
yeah, then you piled all the kids into the family truckster and went to the range.
Well, then actually later on, she asked me to take her kid to the range later on. And I said, no, I'm all right.
Yeah, well, there you go. You had your chance.
You blew it.
Sorry. So the interesting thing about this case,
yes,
not just the result, that's interesting, but it was litigated. The posture that the defense attorney, I should say the plaintiff's attorney took in the case was to establish a record, an evidentiary record, rather than just try to get a motion, based on the constitutionality. There's an evidentiary record here, and it's spoken to in the opinion from Benitez. He goes on to write, modern rifles are popular. Modern rifles are legal to build, buy, and own under federal law and the laws of 45 states. There are probably more modern rifles in circulation than there are Ford F-150s. In 2018, 909,000 Ford F-150s were sold. Twice as many modern rifles were sold the same year. Imagine every time one passes a new Ford pickup truck, it is a reminder that two new modern rifles have been purchased. That's a lot of modern rifles owned by Americans.
Yeah.
She's wanting to suggest that there's sort of nothing novel, unusual, or inappropriate about this, consistent with the Heller decision. It's interesting. He makes the point that despite the ban, there are 185,569 assault weapons registered in the state of California. So here we go. The enforcement, the idea that these bans are, number one, arbitrary, number two, unenforceable, number three, there's very little effort made to enforce it. It's just something to put on a flyer, for politicians to put on a flyer or a television commercial around election time.
Yeah.
And so this goes back to the other question I want you to think about. How should suburban or urban Republicans, Republican candidates, how should they tackle this issue? Should you run from it, like has been the posture of most suburban Republicans in this state, in Illinois, in Chicagoland, in Illinois? Or should you lean into it, especially against the backdrop of the increase in violent crime happening in places like Chicago and radiating it out from Chicago to the suburbs as well? The evidentiary case, he goes on to make the point, this isn't, and this sort of leads up to this conclusion, this is an average case about average guns used in average ways for average purposes. One is to be forgiven if one is persuaded by news media and others that the nation is awash with murderous AR-15 assault rifles. The facts do not support this hyperbole, and facts matter. In California, murder by knife occurs 7 times more often than murder by rifle.
Huh.
And this is this opinion comes as you're saying, if you've been on social media, you see all this, like, you know, orange business, including on country music television, the Bloomberg Everytown anti-gun, gun banning outfit, you know, post orange, wear orange. I forgot what the hashtag is. Who cares? But it's all anti-Second Amendment, anti-gun, because it's Bloomberg's organization and he's a gun banner.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And so this sets up this case that the Supreme Court is going to tackle next session, this New York gun case, which you may recall, at issue there is a state law that requires a showing of quote-unquote proper cause before a person can obtain a license to carry a firearm outside the home. That's in New York. This is the way that states, one of the ways that states, including with usurious fees, have attempted to restrict rights that are otherwise, that have otherwise been codified by the Supreme Court in the Heller and McDonald decisions. So here's the thing. That case is more than about right to carry in New York. It's more than about national right to carry. What it's really about, and it gets to Benitez's opinion in this California case, what it's really about is the standard of scrutiny for gun regulations, for gun laws, gun control laws. And if the standard of scrutiny is codified by the Supreme Court in that New York case as strict scrutiny, then there are going to be a whole host of gun laws currently on the books at the federal and state level that will be vulnerable to constitutional challenges. Strict scrutiny, you know, the highest level of scrutiny, compelling state interest in order to support this particular regulation or that supporting that that regulation, consistent with the standard we apply to the freedoms enshrined in the First Amendment. Strict scrutiny is the standard in the Second Amendment cases going forward after the case that's to be decided next session, the New York case, consistent essentially with what Benitez did here, relying on the Heller precedent, then you're going to have a new landscape. And the question is, how do you explain it, articulate it, and still deal with the ongoing demagoguery, which will only be ratcheted up as it is now being in California when it comes to those gun banners? Because the gun banners won't go away. They may not want to do anything about it when they get in office, because once they're in office, it gets a little bit more complicated. But in terms of trying to use this as a boogeyman issue in suburban districts for the purposes of scaring the ill-informed suburban champagne socialist, sure they will. So how do you respond? It's great to win at the court level, but you need to continue the cultural battle. You need to win at the cultural level, too. Otherwise, you'll be back in court, or you'll be fighting this. You'll be fighting this in ways you wouldn't otherwise need to fight it in perpetuity in the political arena, because you're not doing your work at the cultural level, the educational level, the normative level. Cassandra in Ravenswood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I love it when you go to your second language lawyers speak.
Yes.
It's so sexy.
Isn't it fun? Isn't it fun? It's so you can take a little nap before work.
I called because our Constitution says in Illinois, I'm fairly certain this is a quote, the right to keep and bear arms is an individual right. Well, why don't the Republicans start standing up for constitutional rights? They want to, you know, collective bargaining's got to be a right. Well, guess what? Some rights are more important than others. And that's one of them. And in our Constitution, it is specified as an individual right, not that Mayor Daley, Richie M.,
right,
or any of them care.
Right.
But that is constitutional. Now you can go back to your lawyer, speak. Have a wonderful day. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cassandra. Thanks for waking up the listeners, too, breaking up my lawyer speak monotony. You're right about that. And in terms of the Republican Party here, the problem is the party in Illinois is to the Republican Party what a tail is to the human body. It's vestigial. And it will continue to not exist as long as it continues to be unwilling to provide leadership in any area. And as you say, starting with rights that are enshrined in the Constitution and being buttressed by action at the federal level seems like a good place to begin. But I wouldn't anticipate it here. Phil and Darian.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I got a question for Amy.
Yeah.
Yes.
First off, I just want to say thank you for being a responsible gun owner.
You're welcome.
And I want to ask you, do you consider like a 12-inch chef's knife a deadly weapon?
Yes, I do.
Okay, do you store the handle of your chef's knife apart from its blade?
She does, actually.
No, I don't. You don't get that question every day.
Uh-huh.
No, I do not. I see where you're going with this, yes.
Uh-huh.
Okay, have a nice day.
Yeah. Not only does she, thanks for the call, Phil, not only does she store the handle away from the blade, she has the blade locked in a safe and the key is in another room, too.
Hold on there. Hey, I know you want to kill me and rob me.
Right.
But I got to call a social worker.
Every time she wants to chop up some carrots, it's like 20 minutes just to get the utensils ready. Mike in Union.
Good morning. Hey, when is somebody going to raise the premise of the real gun violence is in the gangs and the drugs in the inner city? When will somebody start making that argument and really, you know, get the premise of the argument in the right place? That's my issue.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mike. But here you have to understand, what's the response you get? Why do you need that? Why do you need that AR-15? Exactly. You don't need that AR-15. Why do you need it?
There's plenty, weapons used in war. Why do you need it?
There's plenty of guns. Look, I'm not opposed to having a 38 or a shotgun. Why do you need an assault? You don't need that. It's the same as you get when it comes to other cultural issues. We talk about it with respect to things like pronoun usage. Who's it hurting? It's the same attitude. There's no thought behind it. It's feeling. It's sentimentality, which, of course, begets barbarism. Why do you need it? And that's essentially what California tried to argue, by the way, in this case. Why do you need it? There's still other guns available. And Benitez, in his opinion, which was really well-reasoned, said, well, there's no limiting principle. The why do you need it, how is that a limiting principle? Then you'll just start banning guns piecemeal, group by group, because you have no limiting principle other than your feelings as to whether somebody needs it or not. What does need have to do with your constitutional rights? It has nothing to do with it. But that is the sentimentality that conflates, that socialists use to conflate the issue and scare, you know, weak-kneed Republicans. So you have to know what's coming, and you have to address that straight away. And that sentimentality, you know, that's the level at which most people think, I'm sorry to say. Yeah, doesn't hurt me. At least the hurt isn't obvious. Yeah, what's the big deal? Why do you need it? Got to answer that question. Benitez did. Will and Skokie.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, I conceal carry because a social worker is too heavy to carry around with me.
Exactly.
the one thing I would ask, and this always deflates my people who are against me with weapons, is name me one army in the entire world that uses an AR-15.
Right.
They use MP4s and M16s, but they don't use an AR-15. And quite frankly, I have a big Henry Big Boy cowboy gun, you know, the repeater rifle.
Yeah.
And it's got faster muzzle velocity. It's got twice the size of the bullet, but yet that's okay, you know. It just makes
right.
No sense.
First of all, and somebody can take that from you, or somebody will take that from you from your cold dead hand. But no, the other thing is the whole like. Name me an army that uses the AR-15. I mean, I know you know this, Will, but you know the people you're talking to have no idea what the difference is between an MP4 and an AR-15.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's like that husband and wife in St. Louis, you know, when the rioters were coming in and they're standing there with AR-15s and stuff. I want to stand on my front porch here in this Chicago suburb, which I will not mention, with my cowboy gun and see if they, you know, say, oh, well, that's a military weapon. No, it's not. although I do have an M1 from World War II, which is an actual military weapon, but they're not going to think about manning it.
I wouldn't recommend standing out there with
get Will from Skokie's real address so I know where to go when things break bad.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Cause they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. A question one would only ask in 2021 America. Would you hire an Ivy League graduate? These are supposed to be some of the best schools in the country, the best schools in the world. And the question is nonetheless called by somebody who is noted intellect. You've heard him on this show. Rusty Reno, who's the editor of First Things, firstthings.com, who is a graduate of Haverford College, which is one of these elite, small liberal arts colleges in just outside Philadelphia. Not Ivy League, but of that ilk. His piece in the Wall Street Journal, Why I Stopped Hiring Ivy League Graduates. Would you hire an Ivy League graduate? You get a, you know, you're at a financial institution, you're at a management consulting, accounting firm. Somebody comes to you with Princeton, Yale, Harvard credentials. Law firms. Princeton, Yale, Harvard credentials. Would you hire someone? Would you discriminate essentially against an Ivy League graduate? Because I don't want to deal. They're not a protected class, Ivy League graduates. I don't want to deal with anybody. I don't care about their other attributes or traits. The fact that they have a degree from an Ivy League institution disqualifies them from consideration.
So it's a bad thing. It's a negative connotation to have a degree from an Ivy League school now?
Well, this is...
Is it 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Rusty Reno notes this incident at Haverford College that we talked about at the end of last year. This sort of performative cry of racism on campus, where everybody's supposed to play a role because this is part of the college experience. There's racism on the college campus of Haverford, please. But as a recent grad of Haverford and a philosophy major, Alex Gutierrez, explained at the time, and this was memorialized in a good piece on the topic at Quillette, modern activists have psyches that are built for the joy of transgression. They engage in activism so they can repeatedly experience that joy, a joy that is denied them in everyday life because everyday life is dominated by the ethics of pleasure. And so they need to invent fictional dominant orders so that they can defy them. This is why protesters would actually be extremely unhappy if oppression went away. They want white patriarchy to be as powerful as possible so they can defy it. You see, this is part of their casting themselves out as heroes, doing something important. This is in part explains the mentality of the COVIDians, the lockdown artists, the same dynamic. Normally, the administrators are the perfect target for student transgression. They take the abuse and they're not supposed to push back. That's part of their role. That's what students expect. You're the front line. You're the man. And we're fighting the man. And you represent that. So you just sit there and take it so I can go through my little play acting to feel good about myself. And then we all get together at the student union later and talk about how
we
overthrew the white patriarchs.
Celebration.
That's what's going on. And so Rusty Reno, getting back to Reno and why he stopped hiring Ivy League graduates, is because he's not so keen on people that have that attitude. You want them as part of your organization? As a graduate of Haverford, I took interest in that uproar I'm describing last fall. He listened in on a all college Zoom meeting for undergraduates. During the meeting, many students displayed a stunning combination of thin-skinned narcissism and naked aggression. The college administrators responded with self-abasing apologies, everybody playing their role. But he writes, if students can be traumatized by insensitivity, quote unquote, on that leafy campus, then they're unlikely to function as effective team members in an organization that has to deal with everyday realities. And in any event, I don't want to hire someone who makes inflammatory accusations at the drop of the hat. And I would add a friendly amendment to that. Makes inflammatory accusations at the drop of the hat for their own
self-righteous.
Well, yeah, for their own pleasure.
Right. It's a sport.
He goes on, does Reno. Student activists don't represent the majority of students, but I find myself wondering about the silent acquiescence of most students. They allow themselves to be cowed by charges of racism and other sins. I sympathize. The atmosphere of intimidation in elite higher education is intense, but I don't want to hire a person well-practiced in remaining silent when it costs something to speak up. So just because you're not one of these intolerable campus activists doesn't mean you're off the hook either. That's the experience to step up when you should step up. That's part of your permanent record, too. And by the way, that goes for non-Ivy League students, and that goes for non-college students.
Right.
That goes for all
those
of us.
The trades, yeah.
No, it goes for everybody.
Everybody in the world. I mean.
There's a cost to speaking up? Yeah, I know. That's why it's important. That's why it's noteworthy when people do, because we know there's a cost to it. If there's no cost to it, then what's so remarkable about speaking up? And you want somebody, again, to Reno's point, well practiced in remaining silent when there's a cost to speaking up? That you want somebody like that in your organization? He doesn't. He goes on to say, to address another group of students within the Ivy League and colleges generally. Some do resist. What about those who resist? They would seem ideal for my organization, which aims to speak for religious and social conservatives, but even this kind of graduate brings liabilities to the workplace. I've met recent Ivy grads with conservative convictions who manifest a form of post-traumatic stress disorder. Others have developed a habit of aggressive counterpunching that is no more appealing in a young employee than the ruthless accusations of the woke. I have no doubt that Ivy League universities attract smart, talented, and ambitious kids, but do these institutions add value? My answer is increasingly negative. Dysfunctional kids are coddled and encouraged to nurture grievances, while normal kids are attacked and educationally abused. They're deprived of good role models at these institutions, including his alma mater, Haverford, so they're less likely to mature into good leaders themselves. Ooh, that's interesting. The indictment of the Ivy League school is less about the kids and more about those institutions adding no value, coddling and encouraging the grievance mongers and attacking and abusing the well-adjusted, so they no longer are. No good role models to mimic when you make your way in the world, at least initially. I mean, on campus. Would you hire an Ivy League grad? How does Rusty Reno's description of what's happening in the Ivy League inform your answer to that question? Robert in Bloomingdale, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, how you doing? Would I hire a Ivy League grad? Would I send my kids to school if we had kids? The answer is no, because basically these schools are nothing more. They teach hate of the country, hate of God, and critical race theory, and the whole thing just turns these kids into marshmallows. That's my opinion. What do you think?
I think you're onto something, Robert, and so does Rusty Reno. I think that, you know, this is not, you know, God and man at Yale, Bill Buckley era. We're talking about present day and what it's, you know, what it's has, if not has been becoming for at least since I was an undergrad. Reno, his concluding paragraph. A few years ago, a student at an Ivy League school told me, the first things you learn your freshman year is never say what you're thinking.
Oh, my gosh.
The institution he attended claims to train the world's future leaders. From what that young man reports, the opposite is true. The school is training future self-censors, which means future followers. Is that what you want, an organization full of followers? We say we don't, but then you tolerate educational institutions that churn them out because that credential is that important. What about the substance or the lack thereof behind that credential? Any concerns about that? What about what you really have once you scratch below the credential and you're dealing with that person on a day-to-day basis in an organization? Ralph and Rantoul.
Oh, Ralph.
Yeah, good morning. I had a Harvard MBA work for me as a salesperson for about a year and a half. She was old school Harvard, though. She wasn't one of the fresh outs. So she wasn't, you know, she was pretty conservative. But it took me about 6 months, maybe, for her to learn, for me to teach her, that she didn't have to tell me in every single conversation we had that she went to Harvard.
They tend to do that, don't they?
That,
yeah.
Yeah, I told her that I learned it after the first couple hundred repetitions.
Right.
You know, I was a slow learner, you know, compared to her, but I got it. And I, you know,
Judy,
but
what,
she never
where
sold
did you,
wait, where did you
where did you
school?
Do your MBA again, Judy? Where? Yeah.
Right. And the bottom line is she was fun, smart, really decent person, but she never sold the doggone thing. And we were selling very, very, very high-priced consulting to big companies, and not one sale. So in the end, not so great, Harvard MBA salesperson.
Thanks for the call,
Did
Ralph.
You get rid of Oh.
Well.
Eventually.
Eventually, you get rid of yourself when you don't sell and you're in the sales business.
Yeah.
Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Morning.
I got two nephews who went to Ivy League. One went to Harvard, one went to Yale. The one who went to Harvard currently has a PhD from Stanford, too.
Wow.
And what's he doing with his life?
Well,
hanging out.
Of course, he's an assistant professor at a university now.
In what discipline? What?
You know what? I mean, he got his bachelor's in physics with a minor in math.
Okay.
Master's in math education and PhD in education. And I'll tell you something, the worst was at Stanford. Unbelievable. I wouldn't hire him to cut my lawn. He's about as left as they come. It's insane.
Thanks, Greg. Well, that's...
Wow.
Physics, Kevin,
wow.
Physics, math, PhD.
Stanford's
the worst. I wouldn't hire him to cut my lawn. So... That's not only what I hire. Would you hire an Ivy League graduate to do household chores? No. I think the PhD in education probably ruined him. The hard sciences, physics and math, that sounds like a pretty smart kid. But
it's a gender study.
But I mean, this is the issue.
Right.
This is, you know, you go, especially the longer you stay in academia, you come in contact with ideas so ridiculous that only somebody in academia could believe them, and apparently, unfortunately, Greg's nephew is one of those people, it sounds like. Mike in Downers Grove.
Hi. My son's Princeton. My daughter-in-law's Harvard twice.
They're both living at home?
I'm sorry?
They're both living at home? Or
No. My son's a PhD working in cancer research. He's one of these guys that, you know, can read all this stuff explain all this stuff to you about the S proteins on freaking COVID, all that stuff. And my daughter-in-law is a college counselor, you know, at a private school, and they're down to earth, their parents. You know, you can't, you know, all their friends, I mean, the people that where they were involved in choir, in theater, in sciences, you know, not everybody's a nut job. Do they have nut jobs? Yeah, but hell, U of I has nut jobs, you know, all where I went.
Right.
You know, University of Chicago has nut jobs. You know, my dad was born in Mexico. You can't talk about all Mexicans. You know, you can't talk about
You're right. You're right. Yeah, of course you're right, even today. But you get the point that Reno is making. It's really an indictment of the institutions. It's not that some people like your kids don't escape those institutions and are well-adjusted and successful and men and women of good character. Obviously, that happens. But it's such a different way of thinking about the Ivy League that Reno is presenting, trying, I think, to get us to understand what it's really become.
Let me just say one more thing. This is why they want kids from the Midwest. Okay, this is why, you know, no matter what they say, they have quotas. They want kids from Illinois. They want kids from Oregon. They want kids from middle-class families. At Princeton, for example, that the kids get some sort of aid. And the aid that you get from Princeton, I mean, you could be making $100,000, $200,000 and get a good package from Princeton for your kid.
Right.
Same thing at Harvard, same thing. I mean, they don't have just all the sons and daughters of the, you know, the deep state. You know, do they have some of those? Absolutely.
They do. Yeah.
Right.
You
right.
know, but they have normal people, and they want normal people, and, you know,
right.
It's not
as bad. Because they want to turn normal people into abnormal people.
And they are a little bit more PC, and I can't put on my Richard Pryor albums with my daughter-in-law here. and the first joke I told her was about streets that rhyme in Chicago, and you know where I'm going.
Yes. Lunt? Yes. Right. Thanks for the call, Mike. Mike makes some good points, and I'm sure that his kids fit the description, but I think the Reno piece is really valuable because you have to really hit people with a 2x4, I think, because there's so much brand equity that's been built over generations for those institutions that they frankly no longer deserve. They don't deserve the reputation that they still have in so many quarters, and I think that's what Reno's getting to.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Tony Fauci, the good doctor, speaking in January of 2018 at a National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease Advisory Council meeting. That's his organization, don't you know?
And what did he say?
He talked about a new protocol for funding gain-of-function research, the NIH lifting its pause on gain-of-function research, and what the new framework would be. Take a listen.
Anyway, so let me just go on about NIH lifts funding pause on gain-of-function research. So let me explain this a little, because whenever this comes out, there's always the pushing back and forth from the press. So, like, NIH now is going to do dangerous research. No, as a matter of fact, it's exactly the opposite. So a framework has been now established to guide funding decisions on proposed research that might be anticipated to create, transfer, or use enhanced potential pandemic pathogens. The program, everybody has to have a neat little name to it. This is called P3CO. So if you hear about P3CO, it's Potential Pandemic Preparedness, Care, and Oversight. Now, why is this different from everything else we've been doing? It's different because remember the trouble we used to get in when someone would do an experiment, they would submit it to a journal, and just as it's getting ready to go out, everybody would start scrambling around, should we be publishing, should it not? So we decided to go upstream from that and talk about decisions that are made by government funded. Remember, we have no control over things that are not funded by the government, but in government-funded activities to guide the funding decision before you actually do the experiment. I don't think this is going to be foolproof. Things are going to slip through, but I think this is a much better approach than we've had before.
Things are going to slip through.
Okay, neglected tropical diseases, just to bring you up to date.
Things are going to slip through, and this is the P3CO. P3 was referenced in a February 1st, 2020 email to Fauci's deputy director, Hugh Auchincloss. The paper you sent me says the experiments were performed before the gain of function pause, but have since been reviewed and approved by NIH. Not sure what that means, since Emily is sure that no coronavirus work has gone through the P3 framework. She will try to determine if we have any distant ties to this work abroad. That's in February of 2020. She will try to determine if we have any distant ties to this work abroad. Well, things are going to slip through. in February, this issue is raised and the funding is questioned, this distant ties to this work abroad, gain-of-function research. Based on that email, based on the context that, those comments from January of 2018 provide, was Fauci fully forthright in that exchange with Rand Paul a few weeks back about gain-of-function research?
When he looked so nervous.
How do you forget all of this about a funding pause that was lifted, about a new framework that was installed, and then you're questioning in February of 2020 whether there were any distant ties to the work abroad? What'd you find out? And why wasn't that shared? And how can you be playing dumb 16 months later? Those are some of the questions I have. But I'm not an award-winning investigative journalist. That's why we bring Cheryl Atkison on, investigative journalist, Emmy Award-winning host of Full Measure, author of Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. Cheryl, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Wouldn't you think if anything deserved a bipartisan congressional investigation, that this sort of mess should have been handled really long ago, but there doesn't seem to be any interest in, you know, starting something like that.
The questions I raise are those questions you have as well. What other questions would you have of Tony Fauci based on sort of all this information that's coming at us from all different directions in the last week?
Well, I think it's a very serious lapse that as he steered public questions away from the lab theory, as they called it at the time, and tried to make that sound conspiratorial and remote, he didn't disclose his own interest in the Wuhan lab and the research that the U.S. partnered with the lab on gain-of-function research funded by Dr. Fauci's institute, funded directly by his institute, the National Institutes of Health, in addition to the indirect funding more people seem to be talking about through a nonprofit. But there is direct funding with a gain-of-function study that a lot of scientists objected to at the time, and the chief virologist at the Wuhan Institute of Virology in China. And I would also like to ask him, you know, about his naivete when he says that the scientists in China he somehow trusts as if they're separate from the government, the communist government and the military structure, which I'm sort of an amateur at this, but even I know that's not the case. You'd think that our top infectious public health official would know this. So I think those are two areas for sure that need to be probed.
What about the fact that Fauci knew school-age kids were not at risk, but he continued to advocate for school closings?
Yeah.
I mean, that came out in the emails, too, which upset a lot of parents because a lot of lives were lost from COVID suicides. And because sports were shut down in so many states, you know, typically blue states, kids lost out on millions of dollars worth of scholarships.
Listen, people know, and chief scientists I spoke to who have proven correct, not incorrect as so many public health officials, correct on these matters, knew that last March and said the school should not be shut down and said that children were and remain at almost zero risk for any serious illness. They don't carry it typically to their families, and that it's a safer place for them to be out of the house together at a school with other young people that, again, have statistically almost zero risk of serious illness from coronavirus. But one of the really troubling things that I have in my investigation at CherylAtkison.com mm-hmm. was many scientists I spoke to, including a year ago, more than a year ago, were saying that they disagreed and knew that some of this public health advice, or thought at least that it was wrong and incorrect, but feared speaking out for fear of appearing to contradict Dr. Fauci, who was sort of lionized in the media. And also they feared this media campaign of being falsely labeled a coronavirus doubter if they spoke to some of these things. So that's pretty scary.
Well, in addition, you know, you mentioned naivete, or I would say false naivete, this babe in the woods routine that he's doing. The Wall Street Journal's story out yesterday, a study prepared in May of 2020, more than a year ago, by the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California, and was drawn on by the State Department when it conducted an inquiry into the pandemic's origins during the final months of the Trump administration. This governmental lab concluded that the hypothesis claiming the virus leaked from a Chinese lab in Wuhan was plausible and deserved further investigation. That was in May of 2020. That informed the last few months of the Trump administration. So how are we now, more than a year later, or even if you just, to be generous, 8 months later from the end of the Trump administration, you know, the last few months to present, pretending like, yeah, you know what? I think it's a good idea to investigate that hypothesis. Francis Collins is saying it. Tony Fauci, sure, we should investigate. What were you doing for the last year with this lab report?
Well, and one has to remember, as I recently reported, that we conducted secretly, but as you would imagine we would do, a genetic analysis almost immediately in this pandemic, and saw and concluded, our scientists that do this, that it contained the hallmarks of man's intervention.
Right.
And without the samples from China, we couldn't say for sure a lot of the details, but they concluded this long ago, but were, first of all, not authorized to speak to it, and second of all, afraid to speak to it, because we in the press, as well as others, made this conversation the stuff of conspiracy theories, made it impossible to be had. The stuff that we're talking about now should have been done over a year ago. And one has to wonder how things might be different if we had more information, you know, sooner on a lot of these things that we should have had a long time ago, the conversation that should have already taken place.
You know, I wish Tony Fauci would be subjected to somebody who actually goes point for point, you know, who really gets detailed with the question. So you can't just wave off your reversals by saying, oh, I follow the science and the data. I follow the science and the data, because you didn't. And so somebody like you, for example, I'm thinking about, you know, he went from downplaying the virus, urging people not to panic in the early stages. It certainly wasn't advocating anything to lockdowns, to being lockdown Tony. He made the case that masks achieve nothing in terms of disease mitigation, only to say that they're essential. And if, you know, if you want to wear goggles and a shield, you know, have at it.
Double mask, triple mask.
Yeah.
And people listen to him, and they're still listening to him, Cheryl.
Yeah. They listen to him, except they don't listen to him. We sort of didn't listen to him initially, or we did, but then we've forgotten that we listened to him saying something 180 degrees different than what he ultimately said. And so, you know, it'd just be nice to nail him down. The moment you changed your view, and specifically, what was the study or the data set that informed that change of view, rather than just being able to wave off these reversals by making generic appeals to science and data?
Well, I would argue there are some other important questions to be asked as to why are public health officials would knowingly do some of these things that you suggest they've done. And you have to ask yourself, what was the purpose of this controversial research that so many scientists said shouldn't be done because it was too dangerous, but we did anyway? And again, as I report in my story, they, meaning our government, likely in partnership with industry in some respect, because this is always done as a partnership, were trying to invent a vaccine for coronavirus and other therapeutics in advance. And they were also using coronavirus, as has been done for decades, in an attempt to make it a vaccine vector, as they call it, to deliver vaccines for other things. So they're experimenting with this very dangerous pathogen for the purpose of a, some might say, or at least we should ask, profit-driven motive with industry to make vaccines and therapeutics. Now, their answer would be, while we were doing a good thing because we were trying to anticipate what that coronavirus might cross into people naturally, and we would be ready for it with these vaccines and therapeutics. But you have to wonder, the way our government has been co-opted by the pharmaceutical industry, if any of those influences were at play in doing this research.
Well, on vaccines, I mean, this is another area. Tony Fauci was very lukewarm on vaccines at the beginning. I mean,
yeah,
maybe
they said a mask was more secure than a vaccine.
Well, Redfield said that. Yeah. But Fauci was very lukewarm. Maybe he would say, well, because I didn't believe it was possible to get it done in a year. I thought we were talking about years and years and years, so I don't want to give people false hope. He's going to give some sort of politician's answer, I'm sure. But he was. The record still reflects, and he's a man of science and data, not managing public expectation. So he can't have it both ways, and he just gets away with this stuff. It's so unnerving.
You know, I just think if anybody had said, including the head of the nonprofit that also funneled money, U.S. taxpayer funds, to the Wuhan lab in China, and was also saying this lab theory was ridiculous, neither he nor Fauci disclosed when they were saying these things, as I mentioned, that they were directly involved in the research or funding the research with U.S. tax dollars. That's a conflict of interest that has to be disclosed and was not. So, you know, we have to question the reasons they were saying all of the things they did. And what else is in the background? You know, what was the motivational factors behind, you know, all of these things that they did that did not necessarily seem to be in the interest of the public health?
Yeah, Judicial Watch got the records, $826,000 for bat coronavirus research from 2014 to 2019 that we're finding out now. Why did we find it out then? Why wasn't it disclosed preemptively like you're suggesting? Absolutely good questions.
So, Cheryl, are you, obviously you've tried to interview Dr. Fauci. Have you gotten anywhere with that?
No, he has declined my multiple interview requests.
Yeah.
And you know, kind of surprised me because it seems like it's not that hard to get an interview with him. And TV program feeds to 43 million households every Sunday. It's not an insignificant audience, but he did not.
Maybe if you dress up like John Berman, you'll have a better chance. You know, it's interesting, too. He may start to run out of outlets. Vox, this is...
celebrated him.
But quoting from Vox, after a year of debates over mass mandates, lockdowns, school closures, that mixed evidence might suggest a certain fatalism. Did none of these state policies really matter? Or was the virus going to spread no matter what we did? Was it all for nothing?
Yep.
If you look at the list of states by their number of COVID-19 deaths per capita, it's hard to discern much of a pattern. Uh-oh, when you're starting to get skepticism from Vox, you know, Tony Fauci may really have to stick to rotating between Berman and Lemon.
Yeah, I'll tell you. And I visited many places in the past year. I think I went to 21 states, including several that did not shut down when coronavirus came to town. Ekalaka, Montana is one small town, kept schools open, played a full season of fall sports, had no spikes, had no deaths when I was there, except four in a nursing home, which was the only place that was strictly controlled. Mm-hmm. Every place else was not closed. They were not masking typically or doing any of these special measures. They had, you know, coronavirus came, but they really had no spike or noticeable detrimental effects compared to these big cities that had shut down. Same with Queen Creek, Arizona. They went to school last August or last fall. The teachers didn't want to, but they managed to crack that nut, and they went anyway. They had no unordinary spikes with their strategy, and I visited many towns that had similar stories. And so the one-size-fits-all, I mean, clearly New York had a horrible, horrible problem at the beginning, as did some other cities, but the one-size-fits-all of shutting everybody down at the same time is that this was going to, you know, mitigate this disease. I think we'll look back and say that was probably, as maybe we already are, probably not the right decision.
She is investigative journalist Cheryl Atkison, Emmy Award winner, and the host of Full Measure. Also the author of Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. Get all of her info. Sign up for all of her programs at CherylAtkison.com. Cheryl, as always, appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, and she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Mike Madigan runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when you're moving out. When you're moving out.
That is what has become a signature song of this show, brought to you by our friend Tim O'Donnell, who actually moved out.
Oh, he did?
He's in Tennessee now. That means it's time for Ted Dabrowski. Ted, we'll bring you in on this conversation. You can referee it if you'd like. Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.org. Annie would like to up our bet or have a chance to up
our
bet.
I want to start over.
Right. Right now the bet is $100 that Governor Pritzker will not run again. She doesn't think he will run again. I know he is going to run again. She would like to make that $100,000 based on late-breaking information she has. And here's what I'll do for you.
What?
It's real simple. You get me a proof of funds letter, and we'll talk about that $100,000.
Shoot. What about a used minivan?
That is not market. That is not $100,000. You can continue piling up goods. And
okay, well, let me just, can I defend myself here? First of all, Governor Pritzker went on with Craig Wall and dropped the ball, you know, dangled the little carrot in front of people.
It's a long decision process. This is a hard job. You know, it takes you away from your family quite a lot. That is part of the job that I haven't enjoyed, is being away from my kids and my wife.
Kids and my wife. No, she knows where she stands. And then he went on Channel 2.
I haven't talked to my family completely about this, and I need to spend time with them to have that conversation.
So what I was told by an insider, and Dan loves my insider because I never tell them who they are, that the Democrats don't want him to run again because he's a liability.
Is that right?
They're worried that more maybe nursing home deaths are going to be revealed. Mm-hmm. His knee-jerk reactions to COVID when he shut everything down, destroyed businesses, destroyed our children's lives, didn't let us play sports, then took away, extracurricular, what do you call it? Oh, my God, I can't.
Extracurricular.
Not extracurricular, just travel sports, excuse me, you know, club sports. Uh-huh. And he's also realizing that the job is more than he signed up for. I mean, he was going away for Thanksgiving. And Marianne Ahern and I called him out, and then the next day he came and said, no, I've got to stay here and stop harassing my family, and you're putting my family's lives at risk. That's why they're in Florida. But it's because of his draconian measures that they fled to the free state of Florida.
Mm-hmm. That's the sum total of your case? You want to put $100,000 on that case you have from your inside source, which is...
He's not going to run.
Which is laughable. You want to, based on what you said, that argument, you would put $100,000 on that. Ted, you want a piece of this action?
Yeah, I'm with you, Dan. You know, this is shucks. This is tough. You know, they're getting to do everything they want. You know, they've passed every policy they wanted and more. And you can look at it from sex ed classes to the closing of schools, everything they've wanted. And I think this is just a
publicity.
An shucks. So please ask me to come back, kind of thing.
A Ogden and Frey poll conducted June 4th and June 5th, this past Friday and Saturday.
Yes.
752 respondents, plus or minus 3.65%. The approval rating for one J.B. Pritzker.
Oh, my God. What is it?
57.5%. So 57.5% approval rating plus $35 million in the bank as an opener. He spent $150 million last time, and he could do that again easily, and then some, and he will. So you want to put $100,000 on your argument, do you?
Fine, I'll go back to 100.
I'm not done. Rich Miller, who is much closer to these two tubs of goo than I am. I ran into the first lady last week at a Springfield restaurant. She told me how she'd taken the staff roller skating at a local rink and said she wanted to host a legislative roller skating night during next spring session. Does that sound like someone who isn't happy with the lifestyle? Pre-pandemic, she regularly attended plays put on by women prisoners at Logan Correctional Center, actively supports the prison's culinary program. She's about to host a big reception for the new executive director of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Yes, her teen daughter has been maliciously targeted by right-wing media for being a kid, blah, blah, blah. But from all I can tell, MK is a trooper. She is also from a political family. You want to up it to 100 grand? Because I'm game, but I can cover it.
Let's just go back to 100.
Would you like to pay me 100 now, or do you want to wait till he announces?
No, I'm going to wait.
Oh, you're going to wait. Okay, all right.
He may announce that he's going to run, then later on drop out and let Juliana Stratton take over.
Sure, of course. Yeah. I know. This is like here's an idea of something that could happen, coming from my head.
Yay! No, coming from my mouth. Yes.
Well, I'm going to invent.
I'm not inventing.
He could get hit by a meteor. That's possible too.
Okay,
wait.
What if there's
an extemporaneous
situation that happens? Do I still get the $100?
What if
he gets sick or something? Oh my God, we shouldn't even.
No, if he chooses not to run again,
then you are going to give me $100.
Right.
Hey, Dan and Amy, I got a bigger question though. Does it matter? Right. That when you look at the maps they've created, the Supreme Court maps, the amount of powers, the union power they've given the unions in the amendment. does it matter who runs on the Democratic side in the near term?
He's got a 58% approval rating. That just tells you everything. It doesn't matter. People don't care in the state. The majority, by the way, so the right track, wrong track, it's 40-60 wrong track. That number used to be 15-85 right track versus wrong track. Now it's 40-60. This majority of the electorate is driving that, hey, things are getting better. I mean,
he made it
by every metric, things have gotten worse than Illinois was pre-pandemic, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I mean, this is what's just so laughable. Don't, you know, this is like, if you think that what you're thinking as a sensible, common sense, center right person is where the majority is going and they're so upset about these lockdown policies, then you're just not looking at the numbers. You need to ask yourself how thick your bubble is, sister and brother.
Yeah, Dan, what is interesting is that, you know, and you're right about that on that Ogden and Fry poll that I was just looking at, and you see the good numbers for Pritzker. You're right about this, you know, direction of the state. There's some silver lining, though, when they're starting to pass some things that I think are going further and further from the population. And over time, will it wake them up or not? That's what we've been waiting on for a long time. It hasn't seemed to work yet. But, you know, this sex education bill they passed, most people, especially the older people, are absolutely against it. The younger crowd, all for it. And so I think it'll be a question of, you know, how that dynamic plays out between the young and the old over time.
Well, you're right. So those are 70% issues. 70% of the population is opposed to the component parts of that sex education bill when they are told what's in it. But here's the problem, Ted. We've talked about this for eons. Who's going to make the argument besides, you know, us on this talk show or, you know, some one-off groups or one-off parents groups or just one-off conservatives around the state? There's no opposition party, and there's certainly, to the extent that it exists on paper, there's nobody willing to take up that cause. Maybe Darren Bailey. He's about the only one I've heard speak to moral issues. I mean, you know, who's actually a candidate for governor, a candidate for something substantial. They don't want to make arguments on cultural issues because they're too scaredy cat. So what's the point? Where's it going to come from?
I think that's right. That's why they keep getting away with passing all these bills. Nobody stood up yet. And I think that, you know, we just finished a legislative session, and that's kind of my takeaway, is that they got away with passing anything they wanted. The opposition was weak, or it wasn't there. Certainly the debate wasn't there. And, of course, the maneuvers the Democratic Party used with, you know, passing bills at the last moment, and, you know, super majorities will become super, super majorities after this map making process. So it's we're kind of locked in for a while until things get so bad that the chaos ensues, but God knows how long that takes.
All right, so this Friday, 6-11, people are so excited. Everyone's going to be free. We're going to be back to normal, except for our school children who are still in class. Chicago Public Schools, I know you guys are done, but still in class only 2 days a week, and everyone's masked all the time. And how the heck are we going to get off this exit ramp?
Yeah, you're seeing everybody start to relax all these mask mandates, and it's you know, pretty interesting. I was down in Florida, as we guys know, a couple months ago, and nobody was wearing masks, or most people weren't wearing masks. Well, it's starting to look like that more and more here, maybe less so in Chicago, but it's starting to happen. And yet in our schools, where the kids who run virtually no risk at all, and where, you know, most of the 65 and older adults in Illinois are now vaccinated, why are we continuing to mask them? It's time to let that go and just let the kids be kids and let them start to live the life that they should be living.
Speaking of Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis appeared at the 2021 Pepsi Gulf Coast Jam in Panama City Beach.
That's awesome.
Country music festival featuring Lynyrd Skynyrd, Luke Bryan, and Brad Paisley. And here's what DeSantis had to say to the 22,000 in attendance.
This is the largest concert since the pandemic. And the only reason we're doing that is because Florida chose freedom over Fauciism.
Over Fauciism?
Florida chose freedom over Fauciism. Ted, Illinois has chosen Fauciism over freedom.
That's absolutely true, and, you know, we've seen that for the whole time. It's you know, DeSantis is being bold, and it's great to see him. You know, look at the data, look at the science, and that's what we put out a piece yesterday or this morning about you know, removing the mask mandate in schools. And if you look at the data, it's so clear. And I think, you know, DeSantis is one of the few guys, and, you know, Florida is one of the few states that actually looks at the data and makes decisions based on that, not on, you know, Fauciism or just fear, which is really what's been the driver in Illinois. Fear, fear, fear.
New IRS data out. You and your colleague John Klingner memorialized over at wirepoints.org. IRS data as to Illinois' out-migration. People seem to think things are getting better. Maybe that's because people who do look at data, like their own personal financial data, are leaving for greener pastures.
Yeah, you know, the IRS proved what we've been saying all along, is that people keep fleeing Illinois. We're the number three worst in losing people to other states in the country in 2019, and we are the worst when it comes to losing their incomes. So as a percentage of all the income that Illinois has, we lost the biggest percentage of income. People are leaving, and they're taking all their money with them, and they're going to places like Florida and Tennessee and everywhere else, and it adds up year after year after year. So, you know, these guys can keep passing bad laws, but the people who can do math or do data or look at opportunity and look over the borders and say, hey, there's better life out there, they're leaving, and it'll add up over time.
Do you think the census numbers were cooked a little bit? I mean, do you think that Illinois lost more population than it was recorded as having lost by the census numbers that came out?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. What I do know is that, you know, Pritzker spending nearly $50 million on getting the count may have just done a better job of counting, so we weren't comparing apples to apples. So, you know, if you spend tons of money and try to get your census count up in 1 year, it's going to make the other years look bad. So I think they just damaged the comparison base. So things are bad in the IRS numbers, which isn't some kind of survey. That's hard numbers from tax returns, shows us that we're still losing about 80,000 people a year.
Mm. Speaking of finances, man, that CTU spokesman, Chris Giovannis, he has stones that are Raiders of the Lost Ark size.
Wow.
Regarding this walkout by teachers from Chicago Urban Prep,
the charter
schools founded by our friend Tim King, Inglewood, Bronzeville, and West campuses, first public charter high school for boys, black children, black young men, young boys, and
100% go to college
since 2006. 30% of the students are special needs. Listen to what Giovannis, the CTU spokesman, said. The charter school network has a long track record of financial mismanagement, including having missed payroll twice. Boy, the CTU talking about an organization that has a long track record of financial mismanagement is breathtaking. But here's the thing. That's a startup, and Tim King had to raise the money, and then he got some taxpayer money too, like charter schools do, and he raises money every year, because I know, because I participate in these poker tournaments that support his school, his schools, plural. But, you know, this ultimately is the problem with charter schools, is that you still are not out of the reach of the Chicago Teachers Union.
Well, that's been my biggest complaint about charters, and, you know, people love to talk about charters, and I'm supportive of charters as one of those things, but you know, they are, as you see, the unions are getting their hold on them now. It's funded by public dollars, so it's like you say, one step away from a public school, a normal public school, and you know, it's still controlled by Lightfoot, still controlled by state policy, still controlled by, you see, the unions getting in. The real solution is school choice and vouchers or education savings accounts. As long as we have charters only as an option, it's not enough, because it's being infiltrated.
And the good news on that is that there was a year extension on the sunset to the tax credit scholarship. So
yeah,
the proponents there, led by the trades, did a good job of coalition building to work around the socialists in charge of the state and save that program.
Yeah, they did. But, you know, now the fight just moves to next year. It'll be a political year. You know, so we'll see how well we can manage that. But the goal is to grow it and extend it, and you know, have more and more kids, you know, have that option of scholarships, and not this where they can keep striking on our kids.
Ted Dabrowski, president of Wirepoints, wirepoints.org. Ted, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Still reeling from Ken's criticism of, both of the singing of both of us, Amy.
I'm highly offended. You know what? All those years of training and taking voice lessons, and then to hear something like that.
It's all for naught. I reflected during the break, and what I realized is I'm less a vocalist and more of a harmonizer. That's really my strength.
Oh, no, no. I'm the harmony queen.
No, no, no.
Oh, no, no, listen, no, 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 no. You might be the king. I'm the queen.
Let me give you an example of my harmonizing. So here's a little harmonizing of Here Comes the Sun. Pretty good.
Well, yeah, well, mouth it like you're singing it, okay?
Is that pretty? Thank you. So I think I've made my case.
Well, can you just sing no? Just sing it.
I just harmonized Here Comes the Sun, or Tico, the magic parrot from Florida, did. One of us did. All right. Anyway, back to serious business.
Yes, I'll harmonize later.
We have things to distill. And President Trump on Saturday night in North Carolina at that GOP convention spoke about the investigations to which he's been subjected over the years, the impeachments, as well as the investigations he'd like to see completed. That's sort of where he started.
And by the way, where's Durham? What happened to Durham? Has anyone seen Durham? All of this for nothing. It's a shame. It's a shame. They do things a little bit differently. We'll never let it happen again. Now they just send the same information from the no collusion Mueller investigation to corrupt politicians in New York. They send everything that they've already gone over and over. Send it into New York. Let the radical left prosecutors go after Trump. Just give it a shot, they say. Give it a shot. They failed in Washington. They failed all over the place. Between the impeachment hoax number one, impeachment hoax number two, all of these investigations, we failed. Let's send it to the radical left prosecutors in New York. Maybe they can have more luck. They'll never stop until November of 2024.
But the failure wasn't Special Counsel Mueller's, the Department of Justice's alone. It was also the media's. And that's effectively the topic of a new book by Barry Meyer, who's a former reporter for The New York Times, entitled Spooked, The Trump Dossier, Black Cube, and the Rise of Private Spies. Barry, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Book review I read of your offering over at The Federalist described your book this way. I wonder if you agree with it. Meyer has hammered the third nail in the coffin of the Steele dossier. Nail one was Special Counsel Robert Mueller's April 2019 report. Nail two was the Justice Department Inspector General Horowitz's December 2019 report. Your nail three.
Well, I think it's fair to say that you know, there is general agreement, that the Russians did try to interfere in the 2016 election. We don't know how successful they were, but the Steele dossier or these opposition reports that were put together on behalf of the Hillary Clinton campaign, which suggested that Donald Trump and members of his campaign were colluding with the Russians, seems to be based on rumors, hearsay, and supposed facts, which have essentially been proven to be wrong by Mr. Mueller, the Justice Department, and I kind of go through a forensic analysis of it in my book Spooked and come to the same conclusion.
How did the dossier exist in the media sphere for so long, despite series of various outlets, investigators that debunked the claims?
Well, people seized on it, and, you know, I guess there were many people who thought that, wow, if this is true, that's the end of Trump. But none of them kind of went and analyzed the report, examined it. Who were Christopher Steele's sources? Where was this information coming from? You know, as journalists, we are taught and we are trained to scrutinize things, to try to determine what's the, you know, primary material, the primary information. And what I tried to do in Spooked, along with other stories, was look at what was the primary material for the Steele report, and was it based in fact, or was it based in rampant speculation?
Well, have you tried to find, or has anybody spoken to Christopher Steele, where he is now and how much money he was paid to write this dossier?
Well, we know how much money he was paid, and we know that he continued to make money for doing the kind of research he was doing after the 2017 election. I tried to speak with Christopher Steele. In fact, I went, the book starts with my going to visit him at his home in this lovely little village outside London. And, you know, he refused to see me. I mean, Christopher Steele, like many people in this kind of private intelligence or private spying business, they're happy to speak to journalists, but only if they think the journalist is going to serve their interest. If there's someone that comes along and wants to scrutinize them with the same intensity that they claim to be scrutinizing their subjects, they are not interested in that whatsoever.
Yeah, you term them private spies. Other people would say opposition researchers like Fusion GPS. After your examination of this, the entirety of this, what did you come away with respect to Fusion GPS, which is another instrumental part of the story?
Right. I mean, I essentially, all the firms that occupy this industry, if you will, and it's totally unregulated, you know, they are hired guns. They're effectively mercenaries. And, you know, one of the stories I talk about in the book is how Fusion GPS, which was formed by two former reporters for the Wall Street Journal, were kind of monitoring a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, John Carreyrou, when he was investigating Theranos, this medical device company that proved to be a fraud. And so they were effectively kind of monitoring their former colleague without telling him about it. And that kind of speaks to the sorts of tactics and character, I guess, of people who go into this industry.
But you know, I mean, I've run campaigns, so I've had opposition researchers put together profiles on candidates and so forth.
Yeah.
Or those persons related to candidates. And, you know, you want the information to be verifiable, otherwise it's useless. So if Fusion GPS did such a slipshod job with respect to this dossier that rather than being a kill shot for Trump, it has been a kill shot for, well, to some extent, Hillary Clinton, to some extent, the Democrat Party, to some extent, sort of the deep state, if you will. I mean, it's fed suspicions maybe about Trump from people who don't like Trump to begin with, but it's fed suspicions about all sorts of individuals who weren't looking to be cast under this cloud by retaining Fusion GPS.
Well, you know, my concern, never was a political reporter.
Yeah.
My concern was the media. Like, I have been I was employed for nearly 30 years by the New York Times. Before that, I worked for the Wall Street Journal and other newspapers. And I am a great believer in journalism. I believe journalism can do fantastic things, provide a public service. And part of the reason for writing this book was to say, you know what, we as journalists need to scrutinize this type of information. We need to be much more suspicious of people doing opposition research. And we don't want to give them the type of anonymity that they want to have in order to, you know, spread this information.
But
we need to hold them and ourselves accountable to a much higher standard.
Right, but no, you know, mainstream reporters, they saw the Steele dossier and read it, you know, about the P tapes and all that stuff and just took it verbatim. They didn't even question it, don't you think?
You know, they had moved into an area, you know, of intelligence, overseas intelligence. It's very easy to verify things when they're in public documents here in the U.S. or whatever the case may be. But they were being presented with this guy, Christopher Steele. He was a former MI6 operative. He looked the part. He dressed well. He had beautiful hair. And, you know, he talked the talk. and people bit on it without saying, where is this guy getting his information from? Let me go back to the original source, because he wasn't letting them interview his collector. And when that information finally came out, he turned out to be this sort of itinerant intelligence analyst who had never worked for an intelligence agency before and was collecting kind of bar talk from his friends back in Russia.
That's the thing, too. I mean, and even if it's difficult to verify, and even if, you know, some of the if you have a disposition that is anti-Trump, I mean, as a professional, if somebody comes to you with this information that includes all sorts of salacious allegations of a sexual nature and a personal nature, I mean, that doesn't, you know, your spidey sense doesn't tingle at all. You just say, before I run with this against a presidential candidate, you know, I better check this guy out. Those sort of sensational stories would lead one to be more skeptical, not more believing.
You know, I think we are living in a media environment where there are, news outlets on both ends of the political spectrum that are willing to report things that don't have much foundation to them. Here, this kind of bled over into what we kind of think as more mainstream news organizations. And I think it had to do with, you know, the unique fervor of the time, you know, the candidacy of Donald Trump, the hunger for this type of information, and a willingness, for God knows whatever reason, to throw what one generally considers to be journalistic rules of the road aside and run after rumors.
This has sort of been building for a while, would you agree? I mean, I think of stories about John McCain having an affair with a lobbyist right after he was the nominee in 2008 that turned out to be, at minimum, unverifiable. I go back even before that to George H.W. Bush reporting that he had an affair that was, again, at minimum, unverifiable. But it was still reported. It was still put out into the public arena as part of the discussion in those campaigns. So it seems to me there's been sort of a gradual degradation that increased in speed under Trump.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And what I try to do in Spooked is trace this evolution, if you will, or devolution, depending on how you choose to look at it, where, you know, the ability of these private operatives to infiltrate the media, to plant stories in the media, has really mushroomed and become far more toxic in recent years.
And part of this, too, I wonder, is sort of the same thing that some media do with politicians, people in office. I don't want to offend them because I don't want to lose access. And sort of it's the same thing. I don't want to lose access to these guys that are close to candidates or close to organizations that have intel that could be useful sources to me. So I'll play ball.
Well, as I mentioned, you know, I've never been a political reporter, and I guess that's one of the things I'm very grateful about, because people who are political reporters make deals with sources. As you say, they'll protect sources. And, you know, part of the reason for writing the book was to kind of pull away this curtain so that a reader, a viewer, a listener gets a deeper, better understanding of what goes on off stage and hopefully becomes sort of a more educated, skeptical consumer of news, regardless of where that news is coming from.
Now, are you a political reporter now, or do you feel you want to dive into that?
I certainly do not.
This would be like the worst time possible to do that consideration.
You know, I would say, yeah, I am very grateful. During my career at the Times, I was offered the opportunity to, you know, transfer to the Washington Bureau. And I would say to myself, that is one city I prefer to stay away from.
After writing this book, do you still think you're going to be invited to, like, reunion parties at the New York Times, at the Gray Lady?
You know, I have to say that the New York Times has been incredibly gracious and has been welcoming in their reception for the book. They ran an extensive excerpt of the book in the New York Times. So, you know, I would say that, you know, the New York Times is among those organizations that is willing to engage in some self-scrutiny or some self-reflection. I'm pleased with how the Times has handled the book.
He is Barry Meyer, former reporter for the New York Times, author of Spooked, The Trump Dossier, Black Cube, and the Rise of Private Spies. Barry, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the
book.
And
thank you. Enjoy the rest of your day out there.
Thank you so much. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So that Maoist entitled For the People Act, which is the legislation to federalize elections and make the 2020 national election, the paradigm for all future elections. Is that a national security issue? That's what April Ryan wanted to know. She pressed National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. She practically hyperventilated. April Ryan is that former NPR reporter. She's at the GRIO now. She was, you know, constant thorn in the side of Trump and Trump spokes beings. Jake Sullivan, tell us it's a national security issue. Okay, he will.
I would say the basic notion of democratic reform and voting rights in the United States is a national security issue. We are in a competition of models with autocracies, and we are trying to show the world that American democracy and democracy writ large can work, can effectively deliver the will of the people, and to the extent that we are not updating, refurbishing, revamping our own democratic processes and procedures to meet the needs of the modern moment, then we are not going to be as successful in making that case to the rest of the world, to China, to Russia, or to anyone else. And so there is a national security dimension to this today, just as there was through the decades of the Cold War.
Of course. I have follow-up questions.
Yes, sir. You in the front. Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Well, given what you said, does that make Joe Manchin and Senate Republicans threats to our national security? Should they be detained if they don't vote for this? If it's a national security issue, are you just saying, alternatively, are you just saying that having free and fair elections that people have confidence in is a national security issue? And in that case, reforms like are being advanced at the state level in places like Georgia and Florida and Texas would also constitute addressing that national security component of operating free and fair elections that you referenced. Mr. Sullivan?
Hello.
Mr. Sullivan.
Hello.
Can somebody get Mr. Sullivan back in the room? For more on diplomats playing politics, we're pleased to be joined by Dave Seminara again. He's a former diplomat. He's the author of Footsteps of Federer. And Roger Federer, just he won't go away. He's back. What is he, 60 years old, 65 years old?
Yeah.
He's back playing again and winning. It's crazy. I mean, you don't follow men's tennis?
I do. I thought that he just dropped out of the latest competition.
No.
No, he came back?
He's back and winning. It's insane. He's also...
Did you say he's 60 years old?
Something like that.
He's not 70. 60 years... No. Oh. Yeah, he's an octogenarian. No, he's in his 30s, right? Or 40s?
Well, 39 in tennis years is like 60 in, you know, in human years.
Okay.
Dave Seminara, in addition to Footsteps of Federer, just released Mad Travelers, A Tale of Wanderlust, Greed, and the Quest to Reach the Ends of the Earth. Dave, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you guys very much. And you're sort of insulting my hero there in the intro a little bit. He's not 60 or 70 years old. Come on, man.
That's a compliment. That's a compliment that he's been around this long and still winning. It's definitely intended as a compliment. The guy's unbelievable, his staying power. Against these young bucks? I mean, that would be like...
Young compared to Tom Brady, right?
Yeah, but that'd be like... Well, you know, but I mean... It's a different thing. That'd be like if Jordan was still in the NBA at 55.
I love it. I like to see older athletes succeeding. I really do. Unless their name is Tom Brady.
Right. Yeah. Where's George Foreman?
I'm a Buffalo Bills fan.
Maybe George Foreman and Floyd Mayweather can do another cash out pay-per-view event.
Maybe.
All right. So, Dave, what about your former diplomat in addition to raconteur, Renaissance man? He knows all these things about tennis and travel. What about what Jake Sullivan said there, wading into domestic politics like that?
The BLM flags at American embassies?
Well, no. This one was just about we'll get to that. But the idea that the legislation that Democrats are pushing to federalize elections, this has a national security component. But sort of exclusively that legislation has a national security component, and what states are doing at the state level doesn't.
Oh, I mean, all of this fear-mongering about election laws around the country is I salute you if you can still continue following this news, Dan, because I have completely tuned it out. If I have to hear Jim Crow 2.0 one more time, or if I have to hear one more corporate CEO or any other company that I patronize it or used to patronize, the list of companies I'm trying to boycott because of fear mongering over these election laws around the country, Dan, is growing and growing and growing. I'm telling you, it's driving me crazy because, you know, I have a Target that's like 1 or 2 minutes away from my house, but I don't want to go there anymore. So now I'm driving to Walmart, which is like 15 minutes away. I've had it. I've absolutely had it with people fear mongering over the filibuster or the state election laws. I mean, it's the culture of fear. I wrote about this in the New York Post a week or two ago, that the left has created around hyping problems with the election laws, hyping white supremacy, hyping the threat of climate change. The list goes, hyping the threat of COVID beyond all reality. It goes on and on and on.
You talked in another piece in the Journal, and you just referenced it, about BLM flags being under discussion for adorning government buildings. Also this, too, where we're now into Pride Month, and there's apparently a Pentagon review underway to consider a special dispensation for pride flags to be displayed at military bases.
Okay. You know, I mean, is it really Pride Month? I actually hadn't noticed. I'm just kidding.
Oh my God.
I'm just kidding.
Get out your rainbows.
Yeah. And it's so subtle.
Oh, is that what all those rainbows on LinkedIn and every other website
yes.
I go to about?
The celebration.
Rainbow and unicorns.
Yeah, the celebration is so understated. It's almost imperceptible.
I mean, this year, above all else, I mean, every month we've got a different one. Now, was it Asian American and Pacific Islander month last month?
Yes.
Was that what we were dealing with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't get – what's July, by the way?
I don't know.
What is July? It's got to
be something,
let's
make it Swedish,
right?
Heritage Month, because they forgot about the Swedes.
Dave, please, would you just live in the moment and celebrate Pride? Don't look ahead. Just be present with us for Pride Month.
You know what I'm proud of? I am proud that I still have the ability to write for various publications who will allow me to express my unorthodox conservative viewpoints. I'm proud that I'm still able to do that, but will I still be able to do that 1 year from now, 5 years from now, if the left gets its way? I don't know.
I hope so.
Dave, what is included in your signature? Have you updated that? I'm just asking in light of this. Mm-hmm. Susan Goldberg is editor-in-chief, National Geographic. Race card, white privileged with much to learn. So you're probably still in like that pronoun space,
okay.
You know, there.
Right.
Them. She's now in the race card space. That has to be included in your sign-off, your email signature or signature on documents. Your race card, and hers is white privilege with much to learn. What's yours?
Right. Oh, my gosh. I don't even know what's in my signature. I think it's just a link to my YouTube channel and my Instagram. But I don't have anything like that in there. That's kind of crazy. But I'll tell you, she's from, you said National Geographic or
yeah.
National Geographic Traveler?
Yeah, National Geographic.
I'll tell you something. Here's one thing the public might not know. Everybody knows, you know, the media is biased, but when they say that, they think of just the political media, people who cover politics. No, I have to tell you, because I've come out with, in the last 3 months, 2 travel-related books, okay? So I have targeted, you know, you look at editors like, okay, which publication might cover this? You look at, I've looked at the profiles on LinkedIn and Twitter of, I cannot tell you how many editors within the last magazine editors in the travel sphere, sports. It's so pervasive, and in fact, I would say that journalists and editors who cover travel and sports and non-political topics are even further to the left of people who cover politics. I mean, it's incredible.
Well, they want to be part of that political press corps. That's what this sports, quote-unquote, journalists do as well, as they come over the top of even the political reporters because they want to be taken seriously as journalists.
They do. And I think that the people who gravitate towards the sort of soft, fuzzier sort of topics, like they don't ever want to have to cover math or economics or the latest jobs report. You know, if you cover something like travel, which I enjoy doing, believe me, people who are far left wing really gravitate to that. And you look at the Twitter feeds of these people or the stuff that they post on LinkedIn. I mean, it's like, really, you're supposed to be covering travel. You're supposed to be covering tennis or sports. Right. I mean, they're social justice warriors. Par excellence. I feel like, you know, sometimes I'm about to pitch these people and I think, if these people Google me, they're gonna hate me. They're gonna hate things that I've written.
Well, speaking of social justice warriors, in your article in the New York Post, the left is pushing fear to advance its agenda. You talked about Joe Glickman, New York Times. He's a vaccinated photographer from Albany who wears goggles, an N95 mask plus a cloth mask on top of it when he shops, and plans to continue doing this for at least the next 5 years. That describes every Sun Times photographer and Chicago Tribune photographer. They look the same. They've got the masks on and the shields and the goggles. And then have hand sanitizer, like a spray bottle, sticking out of their pocket.
Heroes.
Yeah, there's another guy I wrote about in that piece who I forget which publication it was, but his wife wrote in to complain about him because he insists on having his mask on 24 hours a day, even while the two of them are sitting at home eating. He just moves the mask just a little bit to put morsels of food in his mouth, and he even has sex with the mask on.
Oh, that's...
Yeah,
that's,
right. Yeah,
we did profile him. Yeah, I think there was another guy like that, too.
A wife wrote in about her husband who's like that in Slate magazine looking for marital advice.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you know, hey, you remember what he said? What she said he said, at least? She said, I'll take my mask off when everyone's safe, because he's not selfish like you, Dave. He's trying to save humanity by wearing a mask.
I know. I'll tell you, though, when I go to the store and I see other people who don't have the mask on, because here in St. Petersburg, Florida, believe it or not, there are still a lot of people wearing masks, you know, indoors and outdoors. I walk by somebody in the aisle and I see them not wearing the mask, and I smile. It makes me happy.
Yep.
It makes me happy to see face.
Yep. Or you say, like, amen, sister. Way to go, bro.
You want to high five people.
No, you can't, and you can, and I have. I went to Whole Foods, and there was only two of us, and hundreds of people were masked because it was a Sunday and it was packed.
Which Whole Foods is that?
The one on Belmont and Ashland.
Oh my gosh. That's
can't
right
get more liberal than that.
Beast.
Yep. And,
no, you can't.
Every single employee had a mask on, and just two of us, me and one other person, I'm like, hey, way to go, and we fist bumped each other.
Hey, Dave, I want to get in on this, you know, traveling to wonderful places and getting paid to write about it racket that you're doing. What do you think? We could reprise or sort of do a spinoff of the Steve Coogan, Rob Brydon trip movies. You know, I mean, there's comedians and actors and they've got a certain shtick, but we could do, me and you could do like a policy talk or the day's news while we're gallivanting through Greece or something like this, and then, you know, writing little blurbs for travel magazines and getting paid a lot of money to enjoy life. What do you think?
Well, if you want to try that, my next international trip, I'm going to Ecuador and the Galapagos Island in mid-July.
I've been to Ecuador.
You want to come? You're invited. Have you?
I have. I've been to Guayaquil, the port city. I've been to Manta, and I actually went up into the Andes Mountains, these little villages. Because my friend is a hat maker, like a fine hat maker, and he would buy hat bodies directly from villagers who would hand sew them. So it was a fascinating trip. It was great. But I didn't get to go to the Galapagos, so maybe we should start there.
Okay. Well, you know, the procedures, though, we think our COVID procedures here are bad.
Oh,
my God. I mean, like the amount of testing, you have to wear a mask in Ecuador everywhere, even outdoors. Mm. It's pretty excessive. And to get to Galapagos, you have to take another test, another PCR test, once you arrive in Ecuador, even if you're vaccinated. It's pretty crazy. I actually have a friend in Macedonia who was telling me the other day that he got fined $20 by a policeman for he was coming out of a store. He had a mask on. He took his mask off right before he got into his car. A policeman came up to him and gave him a $20 fine. So maybe we should just be thankful we're here in the U.S.
Yeah.
I mean, the COVID fear and the COVID craziness is even worse in other countries that have become police states. I mean, I have friends also in France who for a long time could only travel within a 1-mile radius of their homes.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, Australia, Australia, you can't leave or get in. So
look out the window.
Yeah, I won't even go to a White Sox game if I've got to wear a mask. So I'm not going to the Galapagos if I got to wear a mask. That's no good. All right, we're going to have to rethink that, or I'm going to have to wait till Ecuador regains.
I'll let you know what happens. I'm going to try to, I was thinking I'm going to come up with a phony doctor's note.
Yeah,
and treat around with me, saying that I would love to join you with wearing a mask outdoors, but I'm sorry, I can't. Here's my doctor's note.
Yeah, Dr. Nick Riviera, exactly. Dr. Dave Seminara, former diplomat, author of Footsteps of Federer and the just released Mad Travelers: A Tale of Wanderlust, Greed, and the Quest to Reach the Ends of the Earth. Dave, thanks as always.
Thanks, guys. See you.
Thank you, and he joined us on our Turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.